Hi. So today on the Loopcast, I have Leslie Ann Warner with me, and we're talking about South Sudan. I think this is something that it's come up a lot in the news, and I think it's been sort of not over discussed, but discussed. It's, you know, if you follow the story, it's there, and I think a lot of people have talked about it. But today we're going to sort of, you know, interview Leslie, who's been on the show before, who's talked about AFRICOM and sort of U.S. African policy, U.S. policy towards Africa, not African policy, and sort of puzzle through what is going on. So I want to start with Leslie. I think there's a history here that is not obvious to a lot of people. I think for a lot of people, especially me, Sudan sort of dropped off the map after the Bush administration and after sort of you know, that administration's focus on Sudan. And so give us a sort of brief history up until this recent sort of negotiation towards the cessation of hostilities, or, you know, ceasefire light, or whatever it's being called.
Okay. First of all, thanks for having me on the show. I'm happy to be back again. So just to give the listeners a sense of a brief history of how we got to this point in South Sudan. So South Sudan used to be part of Sudan until 2011. South Sudan had fought two wars of independence. Two wars against the government in Khartoum. So the first was from 1956 until 1972, and that was the first Sudanese civil war. And then there was a brief period of peace from 72 till about 1983, and the peace agreement that the Addis Ababa peace agreement that was signed in 72 didn't hold, and it was gradually abrogated by the government in Khartoum. And so there was a renewed conflict starting in 1983, and it ended with the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2005 between, and this is an important detail to note, the peace agreement in 2005 was signed between the National Congress Party in Sudan and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, SPLA-SPLM, SPLA standing for Sudan People's Liberation Army, which was the main anti-government group in southern Sudan, which was at the time part of Sudan. And so it's important to note that originally the SPLA-SPLM was not necessarily fighting for independence, but there were other armed groups that had emerged during the 1990s that split from the SPLA or had never been part of the SPLA and had been rival armed movements that during the 90s, they started to say that they were pro-independence, taking, I think they were trying to capitalize on the end of the Cold War and the emergence of new countries in that were formerly part of the Soviet Union and the independence of Eritrea. So they figured that unlike during earlier periods of the Civil War, when an independence movement might not have gotten foreign support, that there might be an opportunity for foreign support. And so that's kind of a side note. But so the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed in 2005. And there was this interim period of 6 years during which the government of Sudan and the government of southern Sudan would try and make unity look attractive. But then there would be a referendum where the South Sudanese could vote to decide whether or not they wanted to become independent or remain united with Sudan. And this took place in January 2011. And the results of the referendum, which were announced about a month later, showed that the South Sudanese overwhelmingly voted for independence, which is how South Sudan became independent in July 2011. And so I could keep going on the origins of the conflict, but I feel like I'm not allowing you to get additional questions in.
No, I'm sort of curious, and I mean, what would you say are the sources of this? I mean, is this really, you know, a fight for sort of defining, you know, one state? You know, is it really irredentism and sort of, you know, forming another state, or is it really the north and the south of Sudan are really sort of incompatible in terms of, you know, culture, in terms of sort of the way these two groups, I mean, if I understand it correctly, the North would be considered more Islamic and the South considered more Christian, or, you know, what are the sort of the underlying dynamics of, this sort of separation between, you know, of South Sudan from the rest of Sudan, I guess.
So the underlying dynamics are pretty complicated. So the Islamic Arab North versus the Black African, somewhat Christian, somewhat African religion focused South is part of the issue, but it's really an issue of center versus periphery. So the center in Sudan was always focused on the riverine tribes that were centered around Khartoum. And as a result, the southern Sudan and eastern Sudan, Darfur, all of these peripheral areas were marginalized under the government. So when the SPLM was created in 1983 under the late Dr. John Garang, it was actually, they couched their aims, their war aims, in terms of a revolution for reform throughout the entirety of Sudan. So a reform of, they wanted a secular system, they wanted a democratic system. They didn't necessarily want an independent South Sudan. And some people argue that the comprehensive peace agreement that gave the option of South Sudan voting for independence or not was really written for John Garang, because he would have, had he stayed alive, because he died in a helicopter crash 6 months after the CPA was signed. Had he stayed alive through the interim period, there's a chance that South Sudan may have stayed united, or sorry, Sudan may have stayed united. But after he died, the rhetoric of trying to make unity look attractive and trying to reform the whole of Sudan through democratic change died along with John Garang, which you could argue led to the independence of South Sudan. So to segue from that point, once South Sudan became independent, there was a new political dispensation that needed to be worked out once South Sudan became independent. So what you had then is that there was the SPLM-SPLA, which had been the dominant rebel movement, anti-government of Sudan rebel movement during the civil war, because it had been the primary negotiator on behalf of South Sudan, they were then exalted as the primary power broker within South Sudan once it became independent. So essentially what you have is a single party state in South Sudan. And there's very little room for opposition. And one example of this was there were elections during the interim period of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in April 2010. And because of the manner in which the SPLM ran the electoral process, they didn't allow independent candidates to have a fair chance at contesting certain positions within the government. And several people that tried to stand as independents were either unsuccessful because of vote rigging or intimidation, etc. And some of the people who were disenfranchised as a result of this botched electoral process then took up arms and started armed rebellions in the periphery of South Sudan. And that has more or less been a factor of that has more or less been a feature of South Sudan since independence. And what we've seen with the instability that emerged in December 2 months ago is, again, a internal political dispute was poorly managed by the political elite and then spiraled out of control and resulted in armed rebellions. That's an oversimplified way of understanding it, but that's essentially how you got from the movement against the government of Sudan during the civil war, splits during the 90s, and then arguing over the new political dispensation under the Republic of South Sudan.
Interesting. So I'm sort of curious, I mean, if we could sort of layer on the United States' role in all this, if any, you know, what has been the U.S.'s role throughout, you know, this conflict? I mean, from, you know, I'll limit it down to sort of the Bush and Obama administration. I mean, has this been a sort of conflict that is, you know, of concern to people in D.C., to sort of, you know, decision makers in D.C., or has this sort of been a sort of regional and, you know, quote, African problem and sort of a problem of that's limited to the continent and not necessarily, you know, a big sort of issue in, you know, the State Department or wherever?
So to answer your question, it's been a mix of both an African conflict and a conflict in which the U.S. and other international stakeholders have been involved. So particularly during the Second Civil War, countries like, so Ethiopia had been providing support to the SPLA in the south, Uganda had been supporting the SPLA, Egypt had a stance on South Sudan because they were concerned about if South Sudan became independent and then became destabilized, then the headwaters of the Nile would be threatened and Egypt's lifeline is the Nile. Eritrea had gotten involved to destabilize Ethiopia. Libya had dabbled in the conflict. And so you see over the history of at least the Second Civil War, several countries in the region had gotten involved. And as part of that as well, countries in the region had tried to broker various peace processes. And so one of these was led by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, which is an East African regional organization that had started a peace process in 1991 that had several ups and downs, and it didn't really go anywhere until about 2002, when a combination of, I think, war fatigue and then both the government of Sudan and the SPLA felt like it was time to negotiate so that they could, on the part of the government of Sudan, so that they could benefit from oil revenue. On the part of South Sudan, it might have just been time to negotiate an agreement. So in 2002, with those factors as a backdrop, also the Bush administration, which had just come to office, got involved in the ongoing IGAD negotiation process. And along with other international partners, the U.S. IGAD were able to broker this comprehensive peace agreement over the subsequent 2.5 years. And that was the agreement that was signed in 2005. And during the remainder of the Bush administration, there was very high-level attention focused on the CPA. But at the same time, during the CPA negotiations, the conflict in Darfur, which is in the western part of current Sudan, that also broke out as well. And so that kind of diverted some of the attention that the Bush administration might have kept on implementing the comprehensive peace agreement between Sudan and South Sudan. And so, let's see, we're at 2003, 2005-ish at this point. Okay, so high-level pressure within the U.S. was within the U.S. and within other guarantors of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was instrumental in making sure that at least some of the agreement was implemented, both by the National Congress Party in Sudan and by the SPLM-SPLA in southern Sudan. When the Obama administration came to power, there was still high-level attention on this issue, but at least from my perspective, there seemed to be a disconnect within the administration in terms of the combination of carrots and sticks, as the former special envoy Scott Gration used to say, in terms of the ways to get the government of Sudan to adhere to certain parts of the agreement. And as a result of this kind of disconnect in the administration, and also as a result of just the process of trying to get several parts of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement implemented before the referendum on independence and before South Sudan eventually became independent, several aspects of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement were not implemented. So, for example, the protocol on Abyei, which is the region between a contested region between Sudan and South Sudan, that part of the CPA has never been implemented, and the part that addresses the Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile State, those places were supposed to have popular consultations, and the CPA has also not been implemented in those places. And something I forgot to mention is that one of the factors that contributed to high-level U.S. attention on Sudan and South Sudan over the years has been the role of the advocacy community here in the United States. And that advocacy community was from the, I believe it was from the Congressional Black Caucus, it was from the church community, and, you know, student activists and human rights activists as well. So that contributed to the level of attention that this issue set has received in the U.S. government.
I'm sort of curious. I mean, in terms of bureaucracies and offices, I mean, is this, you know, at first cut, I mean, is this really a state issue, or is this sort of an, also an issue for DOD? Because, I mean, it seems like, you know, a lot of what's going on involves, you know, I mean, would you consider it to be something, you know, that is being led by state, more by state, and with sort of DOD and sort of more military concerns being put off to the side, or is it sort of a balance between the two offices?
That I don't know for sure, but if I were to guess based on the way that U.S. foreign assistance is structured, I would say that state is most likely the lead on this issue set, mostly because of the diplomatic clout that needed to go along with being one of the guarantors of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. And also in terms of, I don't know if this has changed, but I believe that the U.S. was not able to give non-lethal, or was not able to give lethal assistance to the SPLA. I don't know if that changed right before the conflict, but there were concerns about DOD getting involved with a military force that still had substantial reforms to undertake in order to transform from a guerrilla army to a professional conventional army. That said, the Defense Department had been working with the SPLA on a process of transformation. So in 2009, the SPLA released a white paper on defense, which was followed up, I think, in 2012 with another paper called Objective Force 2017, which laid out the imperative to reduce the size of the SPLA, which ranges anywhere up to 230,000 people. They're trying to reduce it down to, I think, 120,000 people. And they're trying to, as I mentioned earlier, transform it from a guerrilla army, which was very useful during the Civil War, into a conventional, modern, professional army.
Interesting. So I want to sort of switch gears a bit. And something that, while I was sort of going through your blog and sort of reading on the situation, was Uganda's role. I think what really caught my eye was that you've written an article basically outlining Uganda's position in this conflict. And it seems like, you know, during the day, you know, they participate in IGAD, they participate in these sort of peace building and sort of cessation of hostilities. But then on the other hand, you know, they bring in 1,600 troops, they're bringing in gunships, heavy artillery and tanks. You know, I'm sort of curious, you know, broadly, what is sort of Uganda's, you know, how do they conceptualize South Sudan within their security to sort of, you know, create this sort of, you know, dual-headed sort of policy towards South Sudan?
So I've found the role of Uganda in the region, in East Africa and in Central Africa, fascinating, just because my perspective is Museveni, the president of Uganda, is literally falling over himself to get militarily involved in the countries in the region. And case in point, back when the AU mission, the African Union mission in Somalia, was stood up and was having trouble finding troop contributors, Uganda was either the first or among the first to pony up the majority of troops to be part of that mission. And that is at a time when they had not yet evolved their tactics, techniques, and procedures to limit civilian casualties, when they were being attacked by Al-Shabaab, and when they really didn't have control over most of Somalia. And I know this is off the topic, but that just demonstrates the extent to which Yoweri Museveni is interested in exerting his military power abroad. He has also, I believe, been implicated in becoming involved in the conflict in eastern Congo a few years back. And then most recently, as you mentioned, he's sent troops into South Sudan. So what happened is the recent conflict in South Sudan emerged in mid-December after a meeting of the SPLM. And that meeting was held on, I think, December 15th. And by December 20th, the Ugandan People's Defense Forces, the UPDF, had been deployed to South Sudan. And the rationale that Uganda gave was that the UPDF was there to evacuate Ugandan nationals because Ugandans are, if they're not the biggest expatriate group in South Sudan, they're among the largest, and they play a huge role in the economy there. So the UPDF was sent to evacuate Ugandan nationals and also to secure strategic installations such as the airport and the presidential residence. Over the next few weeks, however, the president, Yoweri Museveni, he subsequently admitted that the UPDF was a little more deeply involved than he had originally let on. And this was also shown in, there were debates in Ugandan parliament trying to figure out what exactly the UPDF was doing. And I also thought that that factor was interesting because technically the Ugandan parliament, they had cited some part of the constitution. I don't know the exact statute off the top of my head, but they'd cited part of the constitution that said that the UPDF deployment did not necessarily need to be approved by parliament. I think because they were not going as a peacekeeping force, they were going as an evacuation force. So I'm not entirely sure why they had to go through the motions of debating this in parliament. That said, the nature of the debates in parliament was interesting because they cited this genocide prevention rationale for why they sent the UPDF in. And I thought that was interesting because it seeks to cast their intervention in a moral and humanitarian light, right as the international community prepares to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide in 1994. And so it makes it seem as if the Ugandans are not going in for self-interested reasons, but really to protect civilians. However, contrast that with what they've actually been doing in South Sudan, where they have allegedly been involved in offensive operations on the side of the government of South Sudan. So they've been involved in operations alongside the SPLA against the rebel forces that are believed to be affiliated with the former vice president Riek Machar. And so I thought this whole process was complex because Uganda is a member of IGAD, which is hosting the negotiations in neighboring Ethiopia. Although Uganda is not part of the mediating process, they're still a member of IGAD, which somewhat compromises the legitimacy of IGAD in being a neutral broker of any sort of any peace, future peace agreement.
Then I'm sort of curious, I mean, what would be sort of the goals beyond evacuation of, you know, Ugandans from South Sudan? I mean, is this really, I mean, do we consider this action to be sort of an expeditionary force designed to sort of, you know, expeditionary or peacekeeping, sort of a force that's designed around, you know, being in South Sudan for a very long time to either, you know, create a, you know, political leverage or to build, you know, a sort of, you know, sort of stabilizing, you know, South Sudan, you know, to protect Uganda. I mean, what do we consider this if not, you know, evacuation? I mean, how do we sort of interpret this action?
So it's at this point, it's clearly gone beyond evacuation because at this point they've been in South Sudan for 6 or 7 weeks. And there's continuing reports of them being involved in some sort of operations. When I tried to call them offensive, I was corrected by a member of the diplomatic corps who said, you know, let's wait to make a determination to see who's involved and who's not involved. Let's wait until the cessation of hostility monitors go in. But what I've been seeing is reports that they're involved on behalf of the government of South Sudan. And you could argue that it is tied to Museveni's historical support for the SPLA that dates back 20 years. He has this long-standing relationship with the ruling party within South Sudan. He also is concerned about any sort of instability coming from South Sudan that would affect Uganda's economic interests in South Sudan. As I mentioned, they have a large expat community. Many of their exports go into South Sudan. He's also concerned about, even though the Lord's Resistance Army, the LRA, is at its weakest point in years, he might be concerned that that sort of instability could create a permissive environment for a resurgent LRA. And Museveni has been in power for, I think, 28 years at this point. And so he's, from what I sense, he's getting very paranoid at prospects for him to be toppled from power. And so he's really just trying to secure secure his interests in the region and thereby secure his own ability to stay in power by intervening in South Sudan.
Interesting.
But a point that I forgot to mention is the cessation of hostilities that was signed about 2 weeks ago that has been blatantly violated by both sides, according to reports on the ground. That cessation of hostilities stipulates that all foreign forces have to start leaving South Sudan. And I have not seen any indication that the UPDF is on its way out, which is, it may be one of the reasons that over the weekend, the U.S. State Department released a statement urging the Ugandans to leave South Sudan.
I was going to ask you that next. I mean, what is that? I mean, does the Ugandans' presence in South Sudan sort of fray that relationship? I mean, it seems like, you know, in the last 2 or 3 years that the relationship between the United States and Uganda has sort of picked up and sort of, I don't want to say blossom, that I think blossom is a little too strong of a verb, but it seems like it has become much stronger. But now, you know, with this sort of issuing the statement by the State Department of, you know, withdrawal of all foreign forces, which seems to be directed towards Uganda, you know, what does that do for the relationship, you know, between the United States and Uganda?
So I should correct something I said earlier. So I'm looking at the statement that the State Department released yesterday, and the statement says, we urge the redeployment of or phased withdrawal of foreign forces invited by either side. And so it doesn't specifically call out the Ugandans, which I thought was interesting, although the cessation of hostilities as well does not specifically call out the Ugandans. Anyway, so to answer your question, the U.S. relationship with Uganda, from what I can tell, is a very good one. It's a very strong one. Uganda is, I wouldn't call it a democracy at all, but it's a stable country. It is a, you can argue that at this particular moment today, it is a beacon of stability in Central and East Africa. I don't know that you could make that statement a year or 5 years from now, but for the moment, it is a decent place to work with. They have a very strong and very professional military, and as we discussed earlier, they have been instrumental in contributing to the AU mission, the African Union mission in Somalia, when no one else wanted to. And you could argue that it was their initial investment in contributing troops to that mission that allowed the mission to improve its operating procedures, and that allowed AMISOM to actually expand its control outside of the capital, Mogadishu, by the time that the Kenyans and the Burundians and the Sierra Leoneans, et cetera, came on board. And so you could see that there are several cases where Uganda has taken actions that align very closely with U.S. interests in the region. And so it's a difficult relationship it's a difficult line to balance between the need to prevent them from being a spoiler in South Sudan and also acknowledging the role that they play in supporting some U.S. interests in the region. And something else I forgot to mention earlier just now is Uganda is a access-enabling partner for the U.S. in the region. And so in terms of being able to conduct military operations, so case in point, the evacuation of American citizens that took place in mid-December, Uganda, it was, I believe the forces that participated in that evacuation came out of Djibouti, but when they were fired upon and servicemen were injured, they were flown to Uganda as a staging area, or as a, I guess, respite area. And so having that military access in the region is also instrumental to strengthening that relationship.
Interesting. So I'm sort of curious then, I mean, this question might sound more theoretical than anything, but you know, what does that say about peace building? I mean, it seems like the way you've described Uganda is as a military power, and that it's a military power with a degree of political leverage, right? Its friendship with the United States, its military relationship with the United States, and that in some ways, you know, it has the ability to bring force to a problem, and it uses that force. And because of its political relationships, it can sort of, I'm not gonna say get away with it, but sort of, you know, it gets the lesser stick, so to speak. You know, it gets a stern press release as opposed to sanctions or legal action or whatever. So I'm sort of curious. I mean, what does that say about peace building? I mean, do you really, you know, naive me, do we really focus on building peace and sort of stability, or is it, you know, it all comes down to politics and, you know, the reality of a situation?
So that is a difficult question to answer, but what I will say is, even though Uganda as a member of IGAD and simultaneously as a pro-government of South Sudan combatant in the current conflict, they're playing this dual role, which may eventually contribute to weakening the neutrality of IGAD as a negotiator. At the same time, I think that the presence of the Ugandans has led to cities stopping. Let me rephrase. In the initial 2 or 3 weeks of the conflict, there were several cities that kept switching hands between government and anti-government forces. There were several cities that were razed to the ground. There were massive population flows. Several people became internally displaced persons or refugees in Uganda or Ethiopia or even in Sudan. You know, things got so bad that they went over the border into Sudan. And so there were several cities that switched back and forth. And once the Ugandans, at least from what I can tell, once the Ugandans got involved, the government of South Sudan was able to then hold these cities, and they have not reverted back to rebel control. And you could argue that that ability for the government to control these cities has led the conflict to kind of taper down a bit, which you could argue may be beneficial for preventing civilian casualties, but that is only in the urban areas. In the rural areas, I would assume that the rebel forces could continue to wreak havoc. I think that if the UPDF were to leave now, I don't necessarily know that the government of South Sudan would be able to hold the cities that they've been able to recapture from rebel forces over the last few weeks. And so you might see an uptick in violence again once, if and when the UPDF ever leaves. And so that is all to say that yes, the UPDF has played this, Uganda has played this dual role, but at the same time, there might have been some sort of benefit in it in terms of slowing down the process of city switching hands.
It's a very sort of complex situation.
Yeah. Oh, also something I forgot to mention is, so Uganda was invited in by the government of South Sudan, as is the government of South Sudan's prerogative as a sovereign nation. They invited the UPDF in. However, if Uganda really wanted to have the legitimacy of, if they wanted their military force to have legitimacy, they should have deployed under an IGAD or African Union or UN mandate so that they would have that neutrality and that objectivity instead of being a pro-government partisan. And the fact that they have crossed the line from being, potentially being a neutral guarantor of security to being a pro-government partisan means that you can't uncross that line. They're for the remainder of this conflict, hopefully it doesn't last very long, but the UPDF will be considered as pro-government partisans.
Interesting. But I mean, they're partisans with helicopter gunships, heavy artillery, and tanks. I mean, when you say partisans, you know, the image of, you know, insurgents with AK-47s riding around in, you know, overburdened trucks. But I mean, this is, you know, from what I understand of it, it's a professional army that's come in here.
Yeah, they brought the big toys. They brought the big toys. And what I think is interesting is, so if you look at, okay, so South Sudan and Sudan signed the CPA in 2005. And I had alluded to before that there were these anti-SPLA groups that had received support from the government of Sudan to destabilize the SPLA. And this actually led to, during the 1990s, so between 1991 and about 2002, it led to a civil war within a civil war. So there was a lot of south-south violence within southern Sudan that was part of this larger north-south conflict. And after the CPA was signed, Salva Kiir, who's the current president of South Sudan, who succeeded the late John Garang, he negotiated an agreement with the one of the largest of these anti-SPLA groups, the South Sudan Defense Forces. And in January 2006, he signed the Juba Agreement with them, integrating them into the SPLA. And many people argue that that was instrumental in averting civil war within South Sudan, because at that time, the South Sudan Defense Forces could have militarily taken on the SPLA and could have created a really destabilizing situation in the interim period of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. And if that had happened, that would have meant that all of the years of negotiation of the CPA would have been for naught, because the government of Sudan might have stepped in and supported the SSDF, and, you know, people would have been displaced, and et cetera. And South Sudan may never have had the opportunity to have their referendum on independence. They never would have become independent. So anyway, the point I was trying to make is that one of these anti-SPLA groups was the White Army, which was a group of Lao Nuer youth who were mostly, they were kind of different from other anti-SPLA groups in that they weren't necessarily politically motivated, although sometimes they provided manpower to more politically or militarily motivated anti-SPLA groups, but they were really focused on local self-defense or cattle raiding or things like that. And in 2006, the SPLA tried to disarm the White Army, and it resulted in this huge battle, and the SPLA emerged victorious. There were casualties on both sides, but the point is the SPLA was able to militarily take on the White Army in 2006. In subsequent rebellions in 2010, 2011, 2012, the SPLA has had a lot of trouble militarily being victorious over these forces, which has led to an emergence of a it's led to a continuation of an amnesty and integration process with armed groups. So the government of South Sudan will offer amnesty to these armed groups and offer to integrate them into the military, which creates a revolving door of people trying to extract concessions from the government so that the government can basically pay them not to fight. And one of the reasons that this process persists is because since 2006, the SPLA has lost its ability to be effective in military combat. They've lost their mobility. They've lost their ability to take on these anti-SPLA groups. And so that is all to say that without the UPDF getting involved, you would still have the SPLA trying to take on these groups militarily and not succeeding.
So I'm sort of curious, I mean, is this mission structure, I mean, is the UPDF fighting for South Sudan, or is it sort of conceptualized as a sort of train build up, you know, as sort of a, for lack of a better word, counterinsurgency, sort of building up capacity and sort of having the SPLA go after the the sort of anti-government elements? Or is this, I mean, or is, you know, the Ugandan Defense Forces, you know, doing all the work basically?
From what I can tell, the Ugandans are participating in combined military operations with the SPLA. I can't necessarily tell if one is leading and the other is supporting, although when the city of Bor, the capital of Jonglei State, when Bor was retaken from rebels a few weeks ago, initial reports from the Ugandans were that they had retaken the city, and the subsequent reports said, oh no, wait, just kidding, it was really the SPLA and we were just there supporting or watching or whatever it is they use to explain their presence there. And so that's one of a few examples where the UPDF might actually be doing the work, or the SPLA might be doing the work and be supported by the Ugandans. But to get to your original question, this does appear to be more of a combat operation than a long-term capacity building mission.
Interesting. Is this sustainable? I mean, can Uganda, what you've sort of described and what I've sort of read, it seems like this is going to be sort of prone to mission creep, where they're just going to, they're there for a month and then suddenly, oh, let's stay for a couple more months because, and then so forth and so on. Is this something that is not only A, sustainable for the long term, and B, is this a long-term mission? Or maybe you should probably flip those around, sorry.
So it's not supposed to be a long-term mission. And so going back to the debates within Ugandan parliament last month, some of the parliamentarians were saying, well, we don't really understand what you're doing there, and we don't really know what the scope of the mission is and how long you're supposed to be there. And they were calling on the government to provide answers to these questions. I don't know whether or not the government provided answers to these questions, because I would be surprised if the government of Uganda is accountable to their parliament. That's my personal view. That aside, per the cessation of hostilities that was signed 2 weeks ago, the UPDF is supposed to be in the process of leaving. That said, there have already been violations of the cessation of hostilities since even the same day that it came into effect. There were violations of the cessation of hostilities, and as I believe IGAD peace talks are set to resume tomorrow, or I guess by the time this goes up on the website today, so February 10th. And I think one of the sticking points for the SPLM in opposition, the SPLM-AINO, which is affiliated with Riek Machar and other anti-government of South Sudan elements, one of their sticking points is the presence of the UPDF. The problem is, other than issuing these statements saying that foreign forces should leave, I don't know that anyone is willing to put force, diplomatic or military force behind those statements to actually get them to leave.
So they're sort of there. You can't really change facts on the ground. There's a statement there, but nobody's really acting on the statement to sort of push them out, so to speak. Is that correct?
Not from what I can tell, but I think that's something we're just going to have to watch to see once the peace talks start and it continues to be, their presence continues to be a sticking point. I'm wondering if the U.S. and other international partners are going to say, or might pressure IGAD to then pressure Uganda as a member of IGAD to get out, lest they internationalize the situation. There have already, so Sudan is also a member of IGAD, and very early on, Sudan had voiced its opposition to Uganda being militarily involved there. And so I don't know how much leverage Sudan has within IGAD, but you have at least one member that is opposed. And then in a very interesting cascade of events, I guess, so the government of Kenya has, as a government, said they're okay with the UPDF being there. This is before the cessation of hostilities was signed. However, at the same time, their foreign minister, who I guess did not receive the talking points or has personal opposition to this, said that she alluded to the UPDF being a destabilizing influence. And so you kind of see, on one hand, people within the government or an individual within the government being opposed to the deployment, but the government as a whole, because it wants to maintain good economic and diplomatic relationships with Uganda, not voicing their concern. And so that is all to say that in reality, the Ugandans should get out, but there are other factors at play that might preclude countries in the region from pressuring them to get out.
Wow. This is so complex. This is like, to keep notes and keep track. And it's, I think I've lost track about 10 minutes ago.
Sorry.
So I think you've explained the situation pretty well. And I think we sort of come to the end of the interview. Before we go, as you know, we always like to give our guests the sort of last word or last comment before we sign off. So, give us a sort of last thing to chew on and to think about.
Wow, that's a tall order. Okay. So last thing to think about would be, I'm curious as to what the IGAD peace negotiations are going to look like when they open up this week. I'm assuming that at some point a peace agreement needs to be agreed to, and I don't know if that is a peace agreement that will repeat the mistakes of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement and the mistakes of the CPA. One of the mistakes was not being inclusive enough and limiting the discussion of political power to political elites, which you could argue led to the current crisis. And so I'm hoping that it does not repeat those mistakes and opens the process to other disenfranchised elements within South Sudan. I'm also curious as to where the security forces are going to fit within this process. I alluded to earlier that the SPLA was in the process of trying to integrate armed groups. They were trying to transform into a modern military. They were also doing a right-sizing process, part of which was disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration, and other demobilization mechanisms. I'm wondering how that is also going to factor into these peace agreements. And then, as we discussed, on top of all of this, there are regional dynamics. So how does Sudan factor into this ongoing conflict? How does the UPF deployment factor in? How is IGAD and other international partners, how are they able to, exert the diplomatic and military leverage to get to basically force warring parties to hammer out an agreement that they can stick to? So I guess that's to say that there's a lot of unanswered questions that are to be determined, but it's definitely an issue to keep watching in the near future.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having
me.
Sure.
Before we sign off, I forgot to mention the blog. It's Leslie on Africa. So it's leslieannwarner.wordpress.com. It's definitely, if you study Africa or even have thought about U.S. policy in Africa or foreign policy in Africa, it's definitely somewhere to go and somewhere to read. It's pretty good. So thank you so much for coming on, and thank you.
Thank you.